History, the show that brings you our favorite stories from Boston history. This is episode 40, The Watch and Ward Society. Hi, I'm Nikki.
And I'm Jake. This week, we're going to talk about the Watch and Ward Society, the Boston Brahmin-led moral police who regulated the content available in theaters, books, and in homes. But before we talk about our city's rich history of censorship, it's time to take a look at what's coming up this week in Boston history.
Monday is August 7th. And on August 7th, 1982, the Red Sox were playing a home game against the Milwaukee Brewers. Tom Kane and his four-year-old son Johnny were delighted to have great seats. They were right on the first baseline, in the second row, just to the left of the Red Sox dugout. In the fourth inning, Dave Stapleton was up to bat and slashed a line drive foul ball toward the stands. Kane heard a loud crack.
I remember very vividly that I heard this crack, and I thought the ball had hit the side of the dugout. And I immediately turned, and I heard the scream and there was blood coming down Johnny's face. So
the crack. The ball had hit little Johnny in the head just over his left eye. His skull was fractured, and he was bleeding badly. In the dugout, players heard the crack, and then the stunned silence that followed. Looking up and seeing the blood on Johnny's face, Red Sox slugger Jim Rice sprang into action. He leaped into the stands and vaulted over rows of seats, then scooped up the child gingerly into his arms.
As soon as it happened, and he screamed, Jim Rice was right there with his arms immediately. I mean, immediately.
The team doctor, Arthur Pappas, had also seen the blood. As Rice rushed the child onto the field, through the dugout, and into the clubhouse, Dr. Pappas sprinted to meet him there. He gave the boy an initial evaluation, later saying, "I saw a boy that was non-responsive. There was blood on his face, his head, there was blood coming from his nose and his mouth, so these are all indicative of a significant head injury." Together, they carried Johnny Kane to the team ambulance that always waits outside Fenway Park during a home game. Within minutes, he was at Boston Children's Hospital, where he underwent emergency surgery to relieve the swelling around his brain. A week later, he went home, and the next spring, he was back at Fenway Park to meet Jim Rice and throw out the first pitch. There were no permanent effects from his injury, and he credits Rice with saving his life.
He's a hero in my mind. He's somebody that saved my life, and, I thank God for him being there.
There's no video of the dramatic moment, but there is a single iconic photograph snapped by a Herald photographer. It shows Jim Rice cradling Johnny's tiny body as he rushes through the stands, looking scared and determined. An ESPN interviewer showed Rice that photograph in a 2009 interview and asked him what he saw.
I see me being a parent, being a father, being someone that's able to think about others. If that was my child, I would want somebody to act the same way I did.
Today, Jonathan Kane works for a tech company in North Carolina's Research Triangle. Jim Rice was inducted into the Baseball Hall of Fame in 2009 and works as a commentator for NESN.
Boston's $110 million highway in the skies, 92,000 tons of steel, 459,000 tons of concrete in the widest vehicular tunnel in the world to smash the city's traffic bottleneck. That was the Globe headline that announced the arrival of Boston's elevated central artery on August 8, 1954. Boston has had traffic problems since before we had cars. Our first-in-the-nation subway was meant to alleviate congestion caused by streetcars and carriages. Already by 1909, there were proposals to build 100-foot-wide roads connecting important points in the city, though they never came to fruition. The post-war boom after World War II also brought a boom in car ownership, and Boston's aging roads simply couldn't keep up. The 1948 Master Highway Plan for the Boston metropolitan area is a fever dream of car-centric urban planning. It proposed superhighways radiating out of downtown Boston in every direction, with inner and outer belts connecting them. Neighborhoods would be bulldozed to make room for traffic lanes, and the Charles River Esplanade would be transformed into a tangled jungle of off-ramps. All this effort was meant to make possible a theoretical average traffic speed of 35 to 40 miles an hour. The first of these projects to be built was the elevated central artery, which was meant to be the buckle and the eventual inner belt. A warning in the 1948 Master Plan said, "Arguments that the few must suffer for the benefit of the many fail to impress the man who is told he will have to vacate his home to make way for a projected highway." In this day and age, a more sympathetic approach to the problem is needed. Despite that, the city went forward with a fairly unsympathetic approach. One account says, "In its enthusiasm for the artery, the city raised vibrant neighborhoods in the North End and Chinatown, displacing thousands of families. The completed roadway was not the graceful skyway that had been promised, but an ugly mass of green-painted steel and concrete that cut the city off from the waterfront. Worst of all, too many on- and off-ramps, combined with higher-than-expected traffic, made the road one of the most accident-prone in the nation." Midway through construction, the plans were changed. The remainder of the highway would be built underground. Eventually, 6 lanes of traffic would top the steel superstructure, known occasionally as Boston's other green monster. The eventual downfall of the elevated central artery can be found right in that initial 1948 highway plan. The tendency throughout the country is for the average vehicle to be driven more miles per year as both the vehicles and the highways on which they operate are improved. Large highways lured commuters into their cars and away from public transit, while neighborhood residents realized that they weren't keen on the idea of giving up their houses for highways. The Innerbelt and Southwest Expressway were canceled, while the Northeast and Northwest Expressway plans were scaled back drastically. By the 1990s, the central artery was bursting at the seams, and the Big Dig project was kicked off to replace the elevated highway with an expanded underground highway. But that's truly a different story for a different day.
Wednesday is August 9th. You're probably familiar with the triangle trade, in which merchant ships traded cod, molasses, and enslaved people between Boston, West Africa, and the Caribbean. You may not know that a second triangle trade arose decades later. It started in 1787 when the ships Columbia and Lady Washington sailed out of Boston Harbor. The two ships sailed down the east coast of North and South America, around Cape Horn into the Pacific, and then up to the northwest coast of North America. They traded manufactured goods with Native Americans to get sea otter furs, then continued their journey west. The Lady Washington remained on the American coast, while the Columbia went on to the Hawaiian Islands and traded for valuable sandalwood. From Hawaii, the ship continued to China. They sought out the rich port of Canton, now Guangzhou. In China, they traded sandalwood and otter skins for valuable tea, filling the holds before heading for home. Instead of returning east, they continued west into the Indian Ocean and around the Cape of Good Hope. On August 9, 1790, the Columbia sailed into Boston Harbor. It was the first American ship to circumnavigate the globe, opening up the China trade and laying groundwork for U.S. claims over the Oregon Territory.
Paul Revere had a large family, with 11 children surviving to adulthood. They would go on to provide him with a total of 51 grandchildren, 3 of whom served in the Union Army during the Civil War. Paul Joseph Revere and Edward Hutchinson Revere were in the 20th Massachusetts Regiment. During the 1861 Battle of Ball's Bluff, Paul was wounded and both men were captured. After a prisoner exchange, they both fought at Antietam in 1862, where Paul was wounded again and Edward was killed. Paul, in turn, would be killed in the Battle of Gettysburg the following summer. The auspiciously named Joseph Warren Revere had already led an interesting life before the outbreak of the Civil War. His life had taken him from a childhood in Boston to a career in the U.S. Navy, serving on the USS Constitution, to a home in California, before being tempted away to Mexico and serving in the Mexican Army. At the outbreak of the Civil War, he was living in Morristown, New Jersey. He tried to enlist in the U.S. Navy, but there were no officers' commissions available to him. Instead, he was commissioned as a colonel in the New Jersey Volunteer Infantry and was soon promoted to Brigadier General. His unit fought in the Peninsula Campaign, the Seven Days Battle, Second Bull Run, and Fredericksburg. However, it would be his performance in the Battle of Chancellorsville in the spring of 1863 that secured his place in history. Chancellorsville was a shocking defeat for the Union. In what's sometimes called Lee's Perfect Battle, the Confederate commander divided his forces and routed a superior Union force. After the battle, political leaders in Washington were looking for scapegoats. In an earlier podcast, we discussed how that defeat led President Lincoln to remove General Fighting Joe Hooker, a Massachusetts man, from his position in command of the Army of the Potomac. Unfortunately for General Revere, there was plenty of blame to go around. During the battle, his superior officer was killed, and command of the entire division fell on Revere. In the confusion, he ordered his men to withdraw about 3 miles from the fighting in order to regroup. Soon after the battle, a court-martial was convened, charging Revere with misbehavior before the enemy and neglect of duty to the prejudice of good order and military discipline. General Revere refused to provide a defense against the charges, which he considered ridiculous. However, on August 10, 1863, the court found him guilty of a lesser charge, conduct to the prejudice of good order and military discipline. He was sentenced to be dismissed from the army. Revere would protest this outcome in an open letter, saying, "At least, with such a record, I had a right to expect from the court, even with my defense unheard, greater lenity than is shown in this cruel sentence. And from the president, even though his attention scarcely rested upon my case, some indulgence for one who has given the prime of his life, without military reproach hitherto, to the service of the state." President Lincoln overturned the conviction, reinstated Warren's rank, but nevertheless dismissed him from the U.S. Army.
Friday is August 11th, which marks the anniversary of one of the ugliest acts of religious violence in Boston history. In 1834, rumors swirled that a young Protestant woman was being held against her will at the Ursuline Convent in Charlestown. There were stories of ritual abuse and forced conversion, lesbian orgies, and slave labor. In July, Sister Mary John left the convent and visited a family in town. She was disheveled and nearly incoherent. The Mother Superior arrived, explained that she had a brain fever, and Mary John returned to the convent. On August 11th, a delegation from the Charlestown Selectmen went to the convent to investigate. They interviewed Sister Mary John, who said that she was free to leave at any time and wanted to stay at the convent. The committee found no evidence of torture, white slavery, or sexual abuse, and left satisfied. That night, a Protestant Yankee mob gathered at the convent. They battered down the gate, trashing the building, breaking open tombs, and desecrating the altar, before burning the convent to the ground. The nuns hid in the gardens and orchards and watched as the arriving fire department did nothing to fight the blaze. The next night, the mob returned, destroying anything that was still standing. A third night of rioting was only prevented by activating the state militia. You can hear the whole story of the Ursuline Convent riots in our 11th episode.
On August 12, 1824, Mayor Josiah Quincy signed an order of quarantine for vessels arriving in Boston Harbor, which said, "An order relative to the quarantine of vessels from certain places in the United States. It is ordered by the City Council that until the further order of the City Council, there shall be a quarantine on all vessels arriving from ports or places situated to the south and west of Savannah, and within the United States and the territories thereof." The Public Health Commissioner had gotten reports that a ship from New Orleans was carrying a sick crew. It's not clear to me whether they thought the men had smallpox, yellow fever, or another disease. But no matter the specific contagion, the Health Commission wanted to protect the public before it could spread. Sick crew members, as well as any goods from the ship that might carry disease, would be rounded up and quarantined on Rainsford Island in Boston Harbor until they were well. Information was given that some of the crew of a vessel from New Orleans were sick and dispersed themselves in various directions, one of which I found in a cellar in Broad Street, the others I have not been able to find as yet, but anticipate seeing them all at Captain Pratt's store at 3 o'clock. The man in the cellar will be sent to the island this afternoon, and any other of the crew, should they be found, and appear to be in a bad state of health.
Finally, Sunday is August 13th. Speaking of court-martials in the Revere family, August 13, 1779 was not a great day for Paul Revere. He was leading the artillery contingent of a Massachusetts Navy expedition to the Penobscot Bay along the Maine coast. British troops had built a new fort there and were trying to recolonize the region as New Ireland. A fleet of 20 armed ships, plus transports carrying about 1,500 members of the Massachusetts militia, set out to lay siege to the fort. The fleet arrived in the harbor near Fort George on July 25th. They shelled the British ships in the harbor, gained a foothold on land, and slowly began digging approach trenches toward the fort. When the American forces were within 100 yards of victory, infighting slowed them down. The commander of the ground forces refused to risk a frontal assault while British ships could still fire on them on the open ground around the fort. The commander of the naval forces refused to risk his ships against the guns of the fort until the ground commander seized it. And while they were arguing, disaster arrived in Penobscot Bay on August 13, 1779, in the form of a strong British fleet. The Americans panicked in the face of the best-trained, best-armed, and most feared navy in the world. They abandoned the trenches, quickly broke camp, and returned to their boats. As the British Navy cordoned off the harbor, the only hope of escape seemed to be sailing inland up the Penobscot River in hope of outrunning the stronger force. Over the next 3 days, the American force was scattered, and one by one, the entire fleet was destroyed. Many were killed and captured, while the survivors were forced to march back to Boston overland. During the confusion, Paul Revere got in heated arguments with the commanders of both the land and naval forces. Finally, without direct orders, he led his men into the woods. It took them about a week to march back to Boston with no food and inadequate supplies. After-action reports would lay partial blame for the defeat at Revere's feet. He was dismissed from the militia and placed under house arrest. Eventually, he demanded a court-martial to try to clear the Revere name. He was found not guilty, but much like his grandson, Joseph Warren Revere, he would never serve in the military again. You can hear a more detailed description of the Penobscot disaster and the court-martial of Paul Revere in episode 25.
Let's move on to our main topic with some thoughts on censorship, a topic on which Boston has a contradictory past. One must remember that Boston invented the Revolution in no small part due to printers who were willing to put sedition on the front page. And yet within a few generations, there was a stark juxtaposition between our reputation as a world-class city for art, philosophy, and academia, and the desire of the Brahmin class to enforce their notions of decency and decorum on the masses. In 1878, the New England Society for the Suppression of Vice was founded by a meeting of Boston residents following a speech given by Anthony Comstock, founder of the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice. Comstock made it his mission to fight the social ills of society. The meeting was attended by more than 400 white, upper-class men who elected a committee of 8 of their peers to run the organization. Women, who were excluded from the organization, would be forced to combat social ills through endeavors such as founding settlement houses, running orphanages, and pioneering the concept of social justice. The society's membership required a minimum contribution of $5 or more, give or take $150 in today's money. It held its first annual meeting in Park Street Church in 1879. In 1891, it was renamed the Watch and Ward Society because its members were watching for and warding off evil. At that time, there were 4 social evils that they were watching for: gambling, liquor, fancy ladies, and obscenity.
The first 3 are pretty easy to spot. Obscenity, on the other hand, is a concept so subjective that even the Supreme Court has struggled over the years to define it. In 1964, Justice Potter Stewart attempted to articulate obscenity in Jacob Ellis v. Ohio. The case involved the question of whether the state of Ohio could, consistent with the First Amendment, ban the showing of the film The Lovers, which the state had deemed obscene. In his concurrence, Stewart famously wrote, "I shall not today attempt to further define the kinds of material I understand to be embraced within that shorthand description, hardcore pornography, and perhaps I could never succeed in intelligibly doing so, but I know it when I see it, and the motion picture involved in this case is not that." In comparison to the "I know it when I see it" definition, the Watch and Ward ambiguously defined obscenity as anything that would inspire you to imagine something inappropriate. You can understand that that was pretty hard to apply. I mean, we're all adults here. You've probably already encountered several things along those lines today. Obscenity could refer to a lot of things, but to be clear, in this context, it refers to sex. As described in Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America, 2 underlying themes characterize the anti-vice efforts to use the state to regulate sexual expression. First, sexuality had to be restored to the private sphere. Therefore, any public expression of sexuality was considered, by definition, obscene. Second, lust was in itself dangerous. Therefore, Comstock and his allies attacked not only sexual literature sold for profit, but also any dissenting medical or philosophical opinion that supported the belief that sexuality had other than reproductive purposes. Thus, even doctors paid heavy fines for publishing discussions of contraception or sex education. Despite the broader mission to tackle gambling, liquor, prostitution, and obscenity, initially, the Watch and Ward Society was concerned primarily with censorship of the theater and written materials. In those days, Scully Square was the place where you would go for burlesque and vaudeville entertainment. When shows came through town, they would need approval to perform, and so they often had to water it down into what the industry referred to as the Boston version. Those shows that were too racy for Bostonian sensibilities were often performed in Quincy, just south of the city, where the mayor was a little more forgiving and folks could travel out and back by train. With books, the process was a bit more involved. The Watch and Ward Society would eventually form a 6-man committee, half appointed by the Watch and Ward and the other half appointed by the president of the Old Corner Bookstore. The thought was that those two bodies fairly represented both sides of the censorship issue. So if a book or magazine was presented as questionable, this committee would review just the passage at issue, even if it was just a few sentences, and they would decide if the entire work was to be banned in Boston. Now, as a writer or a publisher, that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. It guaranteed press, and it meant that people everywhere else were going to read your work.
Many well-known titles failed to pass the decency test. Whitman's Leaves of Grass, Voltaire's Candide, Boccaccio's The Decameron, and Eric Maria Remarque's All Quiet on the Western Front, and works by well-known authors such as Ernest Hemingway, Aldous Huxley, and William Faulkner, are just a few of the books that were banned in Boston. That catchphrase became famous, but it was a little bit misleading. It actually meant that the work was banned in the entire state. After a decision was made, notices would go out to all the booksellers, and they would have 48 hours to stop with the sale of the illicit materials, before the Society's undercover agents were sent out to conduct stings. The agents were a very interesting aspect of the Watch and Ward. They were, for the most part, local college students. In particular, a lot of Harvard men were hired for this line of work. The reason was twofold. First, the Society wanted to rope these men in while they were young, because they would become supporters of the Society after they graduated, and went on to greatness. Secondly, the Harvard boys could read Latin. And at that time, it was a common practice to take these smuttier materials and disguise them as Latin texts. So you, the layperson, would mistake it for the complete works of Virgil, but if you were able to take it home and read it, you'd be in for either a pleasant surprise or a great shock, depending on your inclination to the racy. So as a college student, it was a great job if you could get it. These agents would go not only to bookstores, but to cafes, gambling dens, and brothels. Anywhere that immoral activities were happening, and then they would go back and report with the evidence. Due to the influence of the Society's members, city officials deferred to the Watch and Ward's determinations and essentially treated them as an extension of the police department. When the Society deemed an item obscene, under a gentleman's agreement, the vice squad would arrest the sellers and purchasers of the work as violators of the state's obscenity laws. Even our cultural institutions weren't safe. According to the Globe, during the height of the Watch and Ward's power, the Boston Public Library kept books the Society considered objectionable in a locked room, and the Museum of Fine Arts kept parts of its Asian collection behind closed doors.
As with those in power today, the arbiters of morality were not without hypocrisy. Perhaps the best example of that is Godfrey Lowell Cabot. He began donating funds in the early 1890s, joined as a member of the Society in 1900, served as treasurer from 1915 to 1940, and remained active into the 1950s. While he crusaded against the vulgarities of the written word for over 50 years of his life, he wrote his wife letters so dirty that we cannot share them on this podcast. But to be fair, we actually couldn't find them. The letters are referenced in several books, but we believe they were redacted or removed from his papers by family members before the collection was donated to the Massachusetts Historical Society. The complexity of his relationship to sex is described in Primers for Prudery, Sexual Advice to Victorian America. Godfrey Lowell Cabot, born in 1861, became as obnoxiously proper a Bostonian as existed, a leading light in the smut-hunting Watch and Ward Society and otherwise totally committed to stamping out public licentiousness. Although Cabot was capable of expressing sexual passion for his wife, to a degree she eventually found distressing, the couple never intentionally viewed each other's naked bodies throughout the many years of their marriage, and Cabot took precaution of writing sensuous passages in letters to her in a foreign language, as if English prose were too pure to bear his message. Cabot, irascible and unlovable, a mixture of prudishness and prurience, was nevertheless a well-functioning member of his society and an aggressively prosperous businessman.
For over 40 years, the society consolidated and exercised power. But in 1926, longtime Watch and Ward director J. Frank Chase met his match in H.L. Mencken. Mencken was a journalist, satirist, critic, and scholar who was perhaps most known for his satirical reporting of the Scopes Evolution Trial. A vocal proponent of free speech and minding one's own business, Mencken was raised Methodist but came to, in the words of one biographer, speak out forcefully, pungently, and satirically against the follies of religion. Believing in minimal government, Mencken was opposed to prohibition and censorship. He criticized the Watch and Ward Society for their intermingling with government and the police force as a way to enforce their personal preferences onto the citizens of Massachusetts. In his own words, "I am, in brief, a libertarian of the most extreme variety, and know of no human right that is one-tenth as valuable as the simple right to utter what seems, at the moment, to be the truth." In a direct attack on the Watch and Ward, he defined Puritanism as the haunting fear that someone, somewhere, may be happy. In the 1920s, Mencken served as editor for the American Mercury, a magazine which frequently included pieces critical of enforced morality, censorship, and social norms. Mencken got the fight he was looking for with the issue of April 1926, which contained an ad for a book deemed obscene and an essay proposing a new view of sex as purely a pastime for leisure hours, which sounds like an interesting article that I might like to read. And to top it all off, the issue contained a short story by Gangs of New York author Herbert Asbury titled Hat Rack. The story was presented as an allegedly true profile of a small-town prostitute who was shunned by her congregation despite her attempts at seeking forgiveness. Rejected by her flock, she continues her life of sin, entertaining her Catholic customers in the Protestant cemetery and her Protestant customers in the Catholic cemetery.
Yeah, so obviously that issue was banned in Boston. Mencken wrote to his publisher at the time, Alfred Knopf, "I am against any farther parley with those sons of..."
Whoa now.
"Let us tackle them as soon as possible." Ready to take a stand, Mencken arranged to sell Director Chase a copy of the issue on the corner of Park and Tremont Streets, known as Brimstone Corner and the site of Park Street Church. As the press, police, and a rowdy crowd of Bostonians looked on, Chase paid 50 cents for the magazine, and the vice squad arrested Mencken. Ever the showman, he bit the coin to the delight of the crowd. Mencken went on trial the next day, and no one could predict how the judge would rule, but it is important to note that by this time, shifts in Boston were starting to tip the scales against the Watch and Ward. The population had changed quite a bit from the 1880s to the 1920s. The working and immigrant populations grew tremendously and now held the voting power, and they saw censorship as very much an upper-class problem. And even within that upper class, the concept of being banned in Boston, which had essentially come to mean buy it in New York, had made Brahmins and Bostonians in general the laughingstock of other cities. In a sense, values had changed and people were embarrassed. In a surprising ruling, the judge found that the magazine was not obscene and acquitted Mencken on all charges. Director Chase retaliated by banning the next month's issue of the American Mercury, and Mencken then promptly sued the Watch and Ward Society for illegal restraint of trade. A federal judge ruled in his favor, finding that it was the responsibility of prosecutors and not private citizens to censor literature. Of course, Mencken did not believe that it was anyone's job to censor literature, but it was a big step in the right direction. These rulings supported Mencken's belief that Whenever A annoys or injures B on the pretense of improving or saving X, A is a scoundrel. And he was vindicated.
Bad press, litigation, and the impact of the Great Depression on philanthropy all take their toll on the Watchman Ward Society. And so the leadership is forced to reevaluate, shift its mission, and merge with other groups. Dwight Spalding Strong became director of the society in 1948 and redirected its focus, choosing to emphasize action on gambling and other vices, the rehabilitation of criminals, and the study of social issues that lead to crime. In 1957, the organization's name was changed to the New England Citizens Crime Commission, and in 1975, it was merged with the Massachusetts Correctional Association to form the Crime and Justice Foundation, which later became Community Resources for Justice, a group that promotes prison reform and rights for ex-convicts. All in all, a surprising evolution that would have shocked the founders to their core.
To learn more about Boston's Watch and Ward Society, check out this week's show notes at hubhistory.com/040. We'll have the Watch and Ward seal, a link to digitized records of the society through 1957, and a link to a book I read and enjoyed several years ago, Banned in Boston, The Watch and Ward Society's Crusade Against Books, Burlesque, and the Social Evil by Neil Miller. We'll also link to Intimate Matters, A History of Sexuality in America, and Primers for Prudery, Sexual Advice to Victorian America. And of course, we'll have links and sources for all of this week's historical anniversaries.
After our last episode on the Coconut Grove fire, a listener named Rick gave us some constructive criticism on our sound quality, then described his personal connection to the Coconut Grove fire. My mother was scheduled to go to the club that night. She canceled because of the team loss, but some friends that still went were killed. A listener who goes by Michael John Zook on Twitter wrote in to say, "Fire in the Grove is one of the best books I've read about a real disaster, and I've read many." So we'll link to that in the show notes this week. And listener M. McCormick commented on Facebook, "I just heard the baby whale bit. Brilliant," referring to our use of that clip from the notorious video about sea monsters.
If you want to be in touch with us, you can email us at podcast@hubhistory.com. We're Hub History on Twitter, Facebook, and now Instagram. Or you can go to hubhistory.com and click on the Contact Us link. And while you're on the site, hit the subscribe link and be sure that you never miss an episode. If you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, please think about writing us a brief review. It's still the best way to help others discover the show.
That's all for now. We'll be back next time with the history of canoes and canoodling on the Charles River.